And I'm Phil Latsman. Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN, our weekly mission to keep South Florida informed on local, regional, state, and international news and issues that affect our community with a panel of the area's top journalists. And this week, they are a worldly bunch. Tim Padgett is Time Magazine's former Miami and Latin America bureau chief. He still writes for that publication. He is now special correspondent for WLRN. You hear him weekly during our special focus on Latin America that occurs every Wednesday. Tim, good to have you back.
It is great to be back. Thanks.
Also back with us is John Yearwood. He is world editor at the Miami Herald. He's also vice chairman of the International Press Institute, the world's oldest press freedom organization based in Vienna, and he's also IPI's North American chairman. Hello, John. Welcome back.
Good to be here.
And Kelly Mitchell is a familiar voice, a longtime television and radio journalist who's also had experience covering the rest of our hemisphere in Latin America. She is now a member of our staff at WLRN Miami Herald News as our afternoon anchor. And thank you, ma'am. Good to have you here and back on the show.
And nice to see some of my Miami Herald colleagues again. We've been separated at birth or whatever in Doral.
Well, we are happy to have everybody here. And as you can hear, it's going to be focused mostly on international issues for this show. We do have an online chat happening at our website, WLRN.org, that's being curated by our social media editor, Danny Rivero. You can join along there. And of course, that is available to you anytime outside of the 1 hour that we present this program to you. Before we get into some of the other issues in our hemisphere, let's talk about domestic stuff first. And while the National Security Agency scandal does not directly relate to South Florida, I think we all have our ears perked up on it. Miami is the capital of Latin America, and I wondered, with our worldly panel, are similar tactics being used in our hemisphere and what impact this might have in Latin America and the Caribbean going forward. So begin with you, Tim Padgett. Are other countries in our hemisphere using these same spy techniques on their own people?
Well, they did for most of the 20th century. I mean, just, you know, pick your dictatorship back in the 1900s. This is something that's fairly that Latin Americans are fairly used to, particularly, as I said, for the past half century. And in some places like Cuba, it still is de rigueur. And what we're noticing in the 21st century, though, is that because of those awful memories of, you know, things like the Dirty War, Operation Condor, all those awful things that we associate with Latin America, you know, in the 1970s and 80s, there's been a pushback in the past decade against this kind of domestic surveillance. 2006, I think, Argentina's Navy was caught red-handed doing this kind of snooping on politicians and other people, and there was quite a surprising backlash against that. They've already been through this, and they're pushing back against it now.
You've told stories to me about actually having your work monitored as a journalist working in Latin America, and then like correcting you even before you sent your story.
Oh, when I was a correspondent in Mexico in the 1990s, when it was under the party known as the PRI, which was a one-party dictatorship, we could hear our phone tappers eating sandwiches on the other end of the line.
Crazy. And John Yearwood, sort of on the same topic there, in the Caribbean, This happens frequently too, right?
I'm not quite sure how frequently, but certainly it happens. In the last couple of years, we've been seeing many examples of this in Trinidad. There have been, for example, back in 2010, it came out that I think it's called the Security Intelligence Agency was tapping into politicians, judges, trade unionists, and even journalists. And in fact, recently a report came out that even the president of the country was being listened to. The prime minister has tried to dismantle that to the extent that that she could, but it's still a major issue down there. And then actually, even in the last 2-3 weeks, it's come out that information about a journalist apparently came out from the government was leaked onto a website. It talks about her health issues, partly because she was investigating the government. It's happening, and we're seeing examples of this, but as I understand it, they're working to prevent it. But we haven't seen it, though, at the level that we've seen it in this country, where we're talking about sweeping up, you know, almost every phone call, every internet exchange and what have you. But what we've seen there is more specific, looking at, as I mentioned, journalists, trade unionists, and other people who the government thinks may be up to no good.
And in your position with the IPI, you've heard about these things, but what do you think this example does, this NSA surveillance program and that we're hearing about and learning about more. What does that set, practices and examples that set for other Latin American and Caribbean countries, which we're so close to here?
Well, one of the things, and you know, as a number of countries look to us for some kind of example of how these things should be done, and unfortunately, the example that we're setting is certainly not anything that anyone wants to emulate. One of the things that we've been doing through the International Press Institute is trying to meet with governments and others around the world. In fact, I have an invitation on my desk now to meet with the Attorney General in Washington to talk about these issues, of trying to see if we can talk to the governments about instituting various regulations, rules that, in this case, through the Congress, that could help prevent some of this from happening.
We'll have to be a fly on the wall for that conversation, John. Kelly, well, I want to chime in there?
Well, I wonder how much this will factor in, because when WikiLeaks broke, this was such a story that was picked up in South America especially, because so many of the cables were derogatory toward the leaders of Latin America and in South America. And they made that a big story because the governments that are not friendly with the United States wanted to use that as an example of why the United States is no better than perhaps we were in the 70s. And as we find out who they have been wiretapping and who they have been listening to with a phone records, then if it turns out that a lot of these entities were in these Latin American countries, this is fodder for them once again to say the U.S. practices the same types of things that the U.S. tells us we shouldn't do.
Do as I say, not as I do. Florida's Democratic Senator Bill Nelson this week called the exposure of the massive surveillance program, quote, an act of treason, and said ordinary Americans, though, need not be worried.
It is misunderstood that Americans' private information, telephone calls and emails, are being rummaged through by the government. That is not true.
Florida Republican Senator Marco Rubio says, quote, the threat that we face, largely radical political Islamists, probably a threat that's going to exist for the rest of our lifetimes. It's just the reality. We have to deal with it. The world changed after 9/11 and changed after Boston. It's just a struggle to balance our deeply held convictions of privacy and freedoms of liberties with our need to provide for national security. Kind of interesting. The Republicans kind of going along with this. Democrats a little bit outraged, but, you know, at least among our Florida politicians, Tim.
Well, this is something, yeah, I've noticed too, that, you know, Republicans and Democrats have found common ground on this. What's interesting is that the Republicans really are the ones who are having to do the most juggling right now, because on the one hand, they want to support you know, programs like this for national security, but then you've got sort of the Tea Party fringe in the party saying, whoa, this smacks of all that, you know, Obama socialist Big Brother stuff that we've been warning you about. So there's this sort of schizophrenic mindset right now, I think, over in the GOP that they're having a little trouble, you know, handling.
And as for the row surrounding the Internal Revenue Service, there's one little connection here. The Villages, in fact, there are three Tea Party groups that have been targeted by the IRS, but the Villages, which is the North Florida community, which is North Central Florida community, which has really been the headquarters of the Tea Party movement, the founders are very active in the conservative movement. They were told recently they could no longer have the right to issue tax-exempt bonds to fund community redevelopment projects. But other than that, Kelly, there's really not much to look at as far as a direct connection between the IRS scandal and what happens here in Florida. It's everybody.
Well, the question becomes, how serious a scandal is this really? And was this something that the administration had anything to do with? Where did it come from? The gentleman who took the fall from the IRS on this wasn't even around when right. these records were obtained, when they were told to red flag these types of requests for exemptions. So I think what a lot of people are struggling with on both of these are they real scandals? And I think I've heard great questions on both sides. We're not really sure if this sticks to anybody just yet, because nobody's sure how it's going to shake out.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Our panelists this week, Kelly Mitchell from WLRN Miami Herald News, John Yearwood, world editor for the Miami Herald, Tim Padgett from our WLRN, a special correspondent, also writer for Time Magazine. John, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, I just wanted to pick up on what Kelly was saying. The idea, it isn't just one scandal, it's two scandals. There's so many. And then for people who are paying attention to this, they're wondering, I mean, the whole idea of Big Brother is looking in on us, whether you work for one of the organizations, the Tea Party groups or what have you, or whether, you know, as with the other scandals of your information being scooped up, the whole idea that there's someone, the government back there is looking at everything that you're doing. And for many people, it's a very, very uncomfortable position to be in.
I think I read that the 1984 by George Orwell is climbing up the Amazon.com list. People are rereading that or reading it for the first time.
They weren't even born in 1984
yeah,
and they're
true.
Reading it.
It came 29 years late. By the way, there is a way for us, for you to interact with us, and we're having an online chat on our Facebook page, actually on our WLRN.org page. Also, we have a Facebook page. You can find us at the Florida Roundup. And we're also followable on Twitter at WLRN. The conversation continues offline when we get off the air. Now, I wanted to get into this about President Obama, as he was in town this week, and that sort of gave us a news peg to discuss. What has he done for us lately here in Florida? South Florida still matters to President Obama when it comes to fundraising. He was here Wednesday for a brief visit. He met with Democratic National Committee Chairwoman and South Florida Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Then he headed off to two Democratic fundraisers at private residences worth from $1,000 to over $30,000 a plate. About two dozen protesters gathered in Miami Beach where one of them was held. Some held pro-Israel signs and pro-gun signs. Others were upset about the NSA's program and about the IRS. Florida has been good to President Obama, helping to elect him twice, but has he been good to Florida? I think people are asking themselves now, Tim Padgett.
Well, in the Latino community, for example, in Florida, the thing that's most important is immigration reform. Is he going to deliver on that? I mean, you've got a lot of immigrant youths in Florida who are looking to him to push back against, for example, Rick Scott a couple of weeks ago, vetoed legislation that would have made it easier for younger immigrant children of undocumented immigrants to get driver's licenses. So on that level, yes, they're really counting on him to come through with that. Non-Latino concerns, as an insurance. As a Floridian who pays hurricane insurance when in hurricane season, probably a lot of Floridians are wondering, is he going to come through with things like a cat fund,
right?
Things like that. I don't really think though that Floridians are there aren't a lot of hot button issues right now regarding Obama vis-a-vis Florida. Am I missing one,
John?
What the president has been doing, whether it's in his travels through Latin America, and I guess we'll talk about that later, or his work on the economy, he's hoping those things will help Floridians, as
exactly.
People used to say in years past, a raising tide sort of lifts all boats. So if he focuses on those issues, Florida will benefit.
And what he's been accused, and we've talked about this over the years, of ignoring Latin America. John, is he trying to give it more attention? What is he doing to better relations with our hemispheric neighbors?
Well, as I mentioned, he was recently on a major trip through Latin America, but it isn't just the president. It's the vice president is taking a far more active role in the region. There's been a lot of criticism that the Secretary of State, John Kerry, hasn't been paying much attention to the region. However, he made his first trip to the region recently. Andres Oppenheimer, whom you've had on your show a few times, and I have been talking about this a lot. And my point is, I was recently in the Middle East, and I was talking to people there about the fact that the U.S. government is suddenly paying a tremendous amount of attention to the Middle East. Kerry, I think, is there now or on his way. So what he's been doing is really spending a lot of attention, focus on the Middle East, and we'll probably be seeing a lot more of that, more on that issue in the years ahead. What they've told me is that, after years and, away from the U.S. Attention span, we're suddenly getting far more than we probably deserve. And they're saying, in effect, Latin America's time will come. But I must say, though, that from what I've been seeing and the people I've been talking to, both here in the administration as well as overseas, we're starting to see a lot of it happen. And one of the things that I mentioned Oppenheimer earlier, one of the things that he's been talking about is that maybe the vice president can serve as sort of a special envoy for the Americas within the administration. So we're looking for a lot more happening in the months and years ahead.
All right, we're going to put the comma there. We'll talk a little bit more about what the primary issues are for U.S., Latin American, Caribbean relations a bit later in the show. I did want to turn to the immigration issue, which is still flaring up in Washington, obviously, is being discussed in the Senate this week. We'll hear from Marco Rubio, who's the sponsor of that Gang of Eight bill. I want to remind you, it's your show, too. If you've got something for us, 800-743-WLRN is how you reach us. We're also emailable at thefloridaroundup@gmail.com. You're listening to the Florida Roundup, and we're back in just a moment. Stay with us. And we welcome you back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman. Again, our panelists, Kelly Mitchell from our WLRN Miami Herald newsroom, John Yearwood, world editor of the Miami Herald, Tim Padgett from Time Magazine, and a special correspondent for us here at WLRN, and our live blog being curated on our website right now at WLRN.org. You can participate in that discussion anytime. So moving on to immigration, as the U.S. Senate continues to debate what could be a historic overhaul of the nation's immigration laws, a recent poll of Florida voters shows strong bipartisan support for immigration reform, comprehensive immigration reform. Over 800 Floridians surveyed by public policy polling were asked how they felt about a measure that would secure U.S. borders, block employers from hiring undocumented immigrants, and require that immigrants who pass a criminal background check register for legal status. Three-quarters of those surveyed supported that measure. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill this week, Florida Senator Marco Rubio has been the public face of the Gang of Eight, the so-called Gang of Eight, the group of four Democratic and four Republican senators crafting the immigration overhaul on the Senate floor. Senator Rubio talked about the changing dynamics of this plan, including the tougher border patrol standards and a proposed amendment requiring English proficiency for all citizenship candidates.
Border security is not an anti-immigration or an anti-immigrant measure. It is an important national security measure, but it is also an important defense of our sovereignty. When you apply for that green card after the 10-year period and more has expired, you're going to have to prove that you're proficient in English, because I think assimilation is important. Learning English is not just important for assimilation, it's important for economic success. You cannot flourish in our economy, you cannot flourish in our country, if you're not proficient in English.
And we've been having this debate in the news media here for many, many years. English only, yada, yada. Should people be speaking English? And it's kind of tired at this point, Kelly, but brought up again by the Marco Rubio this week, saying you really should be proficient in English to become a citizen in this country.
Well, now, first, is yada, yada, yada English, or?
I think it's any language.
No, but I think what
Seinfeldian.
Exactly. Yes. What I do think we're seeing here is Marco Rubio trying to straddle the line. He has made some forays into attracting the Latin voters, trying to make peace and amends with the immigrants. But now he's talking the Republican talk, which is you have to have the border security. And yes, I would like to see people be proficient in English. The argument on English has always been your first generation, they may be the grandparents, they may even be the parents who don't speak English, but the children are the ones who will make sure they speak English. And I'll give you a perfect example. I was at the iPhone store 2 weeks ago on Lincoln Road Mall. A little girl and her mother were there. The mother spoke only Spanish, but the daughter answered every single question to her in English. And most of it was about whether her plan would be better with Verizon, whether it would be better with Sprint. So I think the English does go without saying at some point. I think some of that is a smokescreen for others to say, we don't want immigrants in here because they don't learn English. Eventually they do, but Rubio is now playing to that crowd.
Tim, what do you think? A smokescreen?
Yeah, because I think it's a moot point at this point. All studies are showing that in the Latino community in the United States, the phenomenon is that Latinos are becoming more English dominant rather than Spanish dominant. I mean, last week on your show, you had one of the executives of the new Fusion Network, which was engendered precisely because their Univision and Spanish language networks like that are seeing for themselves that the Latino community is becoming more English dominant.
Right, and the problem is going to go away, whether it's a problem or not. John, your perspective on this?
It's all politics.
Quote, unquote.
Exactly. It's all about the next presidential election.
President Obama says, quote, the bill is not perfect. It's a compromise. And, of course, if passed, it would allow most of the nation's 11 million unauthorized immigrants to apply for U.S. citizenship within 13 years. It'll take a long time. And we actually heard a speech this week entirely in Spanish given by a senator, not Marco Rubio, but by Virginia's Tim Kaine, who took 15 minutes to explain it. So this is something that that's going to keep going on. Meanwhile, there's stories this week. The Sun Sentinel reported FIU is going to become the first Florida university to offer in-state tuition to immigrant children, even if they've not achieved legal status yet. We still do not have a DREAM Act to go on here, John. Nothing is passed that, and that's going to help students go to college.
No, that DREAM Act is really critical to a lot of people. And, you know, there hasn't been a tremendous amount being done in Washington, but I think that if there's one piece of legislation a lot of people are saying should pass, that is it.
That should be part of it. And we talked last week, and Tim, you just mentioned Governor Scott striking down a law passed nearly unanimously through the legislature that would have made it easier for undocumented residents to get driver's licenses.
Well, here's the problem for the Republican Party. Not only do they need to get Latino voters, they need to get young Latino voters because this is a remarkably young population. And if they keep pushing, you know, measures like, you know, nixing driver's licenses for the, you know, the children of undocumented immigrants, if they keep balking on the DREAM Act, this is not going to be just a short-term problem for the GOP. This is going to be a long-term electoral nightmare for them.
Not going to forget this.
Not at all.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup, and you can join the conversation if you've got something to add to it. And we're going to get international talk about our hemispheric neighbors, Venezuela, Cuba, and Haiti, even some Brazil, and perhaps a little discussion on the Guantanamo Bay prison camp. You can join us at 800-743-WLRN. We're also tweetable at callsign at WLRN, and we'll have our own Twitter addresses, too. We'll give those out later. And again, our live discussion on our website, where the conversation continues even after we're off the air, at WLRN.org, being curated by our social media editor, Danny Rivero. So let's move on to Venezuela. And we saw an audit this week. And, of course, tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of Venezuelan expats are residing here in South Florida. We heard about the audit this week that declared that President Nicolas Maduro's win in May over opposition, in April rather, over opposition candidate Enrique Capriles was indeed legitimate. This is not a big surprise, but Tim, is the opposition buying it?
Well, I personally, you know, don't worry so much about, you know, the audit, the election results, because for the past 14 years, Hugo Chavez and his party have really made credible elections a part of their game plan because it gives them a democratic credibility, which they then use, you know, too often to try to hide the fact that they don't govern all that democratically. So I you know, if I had to make a guess, I would think that the election results are probably legitimate. The bigger problem for Nicolas Maduro and the Chavistas in Venezuela right now is all the problems that all the crises that Chavez left behind for them to deal with. An economic crisis, one of the highest inflation rates in the world, a currency crisis, and most of all, the security crisis. One of the most, Venezuela and Caracas especially right now, one of the most violent places in South America. Those are the real problems that are going to bring down, you know, eventually Chavismo. And not just, you know, those out external problems, but internal problems. I mean, it was a scandal recently in the country where the opposition got hold of a tape conversation between a Chavista and a Cuban security agent in which it was revealed that, you know, there are real serious rifts inside Chavez's Socialist Party. Between the ideological faction of Maduro and the more pragmatic faction that is sort of, you know, fighting against him. So there's a whole host of problems. And there's, you know, a lot of people are beginning to wonder now if Maduro will even make it through his six-year term without a recall referendum.
Well, is that why we're not really hearing much out of Venezuela in one voice at this particular time? Because they're still trying to put it all together?
Oh, definitely. I mean, Chavez was really the only persona who could hold you know, all of the different factions in this revolution together. You know, the head of the National Assembly, Diosdado Cabello, I mean, you know, he's already been critical of Nicolás Maduro because of the lame victory that Maduro won. And everyone is seeing Cabello sort of, you know, sharpening his knives now and, you know, eventually going after Maduro. So I think Maduro is always talking about how, you know, the country has to brace itself for an invasion of the U.S. I think the biggest threat to Maduro's rule is inside his own party.
John Yearwood, you speak to sources down there in South America and in Venezuela, our own reporters, they work for The Herald. What are you hearing?
Well, whether or not the election is legitimate or not, I mean, I can't say. I mean, certainly, you know, we've seen in different parts around the world close elections. In fact, in my case, I was once involved in a close election where I won by 4 votes, and a former editor said I bought 3 too many. but I wanted to say that what we're seeing happening, but for the record, I did not buy any. what we're seeing happening, though, is that the U.S. administration would have really been waiting for this audit to come out, and it's been sort of critical of the election outcome. We're seeing a movement now to supporting the administration down there. Recently, Kerry met with the foreign minister of Venezuela, and they set up a commission to start talking about normalizing, at least exchanging ambassadors. So what you're seeing, which does not necessarily bode well for the opposition, is that the U.S. may be coming on board to support the government.
Which is
what one would hope would come out of that ultimately is, one is normalizing relation and finding, getting the U.S. using its influence to have a more democratic government in Venezuela.
So Venezuela has the world's largest oil reserves, but recent headlines from that South American nation are about the shortages of basic items, and critics call it a sign of how the socialist revolution has mismanaged Venezuela's economy. And, in fact, this week on WLRN, we heard Tim's report about the lack of basic supplies, including such things as toilet paper, that are not available to the Venezuelan people.
Each week for the Venezuelan people is a problem to find the essential products to live.
If you go to any given supermarket, you don't find anything. But then you go to the street, you see all these people that they're not regulated by the government, selling 3, 4, 5 times the price that is regulated by the government.
Tim, who did we hear there?
Well, we heard a woman, a Venezuelan-American in Deerfield Beach, who I talked to while she was helping her mother, a Venezuelan, going back to Caracas, pack 4 large suitcases full of toilet paper, deodorant, rice, coffee, all these basic items that the Central Bank in Venezuela says that 21 out of 100 basic consumer items are in very short supply these days. In Venezuela. So you're seeing the South Florida Venezuelan community, which is one of the fastest growing, exile communities or diasporas in South Florida. They are trying to find ways to get these goods into Venezuela right now, and it's not easy.
And John, go ahead.
And you're seeing goods coming in also from the border with Colombia.
Exactly.
At least one of the border states, the government was going to institute some severe rationing and handing out cards last week, and Maduro called it off. But at least you're seeing, for a long time, that's where a lot of products and they used to be coming in to Venezuela. And we'll be doing a story about that soon.
Yeah, that was one of the problems when Uribe from Colombia and Chavez butted heads. It hurt the Colombian economy because there was a lot of trade between those two countries.
And meanwhile, the economic instability has had an effect on crime in Venezuela. It's really skyrocketed, right?
Oh, absolutely. Although crime in Venezuela has been pretty high for a while. It's one of the most dangerous countries in the world. Certainly, Caracas is one of the most dangerous city in the world. And we're seeing, what's unfortunate, it isn't just Venezuela with crime. In fact, I was just reading a story from our correspondent in the Dominican Republic about the military being called out on the streets of Santo Domingo to deal with the whole crime issue. So that's something, and of course, Honduras, one of the most, if not the...
Oh, it is the most dangerous, violent country
in the world. So we're seeing that throughout throughout the hemisphere.
In a couple of moments here, let's since they are directly related, Venezuela and Cuba, a lot of Cuba's economy relies on Venezuela's oil. And we also find out that a lot of the Cuban economy relies on remittances from Cubans abroad, especially here in South Florida, which supports 90% of the retail market in Cuba. In fact, last year, remittances reached $2.6 billion. It's an increase of about 13%. And now we're hearing 47,000-plus people annually are leaving Cuba, presumably coming to places like South Florida, sending money back. And this is just growing and growing, Tim.
Well, this is one of the reasons that Raul Castro liberalized the travel rules for Cubans, because what he's hoping is that as they go out to places like South Florida, they're going to pick up capital that they can bring back to Cuba to help his economic reforms, his more capitalist economic reforms, run better.
And we also heard this week in a report that Juan Tamayo wrote for El Nuevo Herald about the government allowing internet access, John Yearwood, now, which seems silly, but is pretty significant in Cuba in a place like that.
Well, it depends on which sites you want to connect to on the internet. It's not what's free is not always free, and what's available is not always available. Apparently, a lot of the sites that people might want to go to, El Nuevo Herald being one of them, is blocked, as well as many U.S. government sites. But at least it's some progress. But one of the problems with it, though, if you're in Cuba trying to get on the World Wide Web, is extremely expensive, and that's something that will have to be dealt with if more people are to get online.
But it may be getting closer. I mean, this fiber optic line that Venezuela is putting in for Cuba, now there's a connection to Jamaica. So perhaps with more access, the price starts to come down.
Yeah, no one is more worried about what's going on in Venezuela than the Cubans right now, because they rely on that more than 100,000 barrels of cut-rate oil that they get from Venezuela each day to keep their own economy going.
And I guess we ask this question constantly, but plans for a post-Castro Cuba, have they advanced in any way in the year 2013? We haven't heard a death rumor on Fidel for a while. That's one sign. But is there any progress being made?
I'm looking for it now around 4 o'clock today.
Yeah, okay, exactly. For the happy weekend.
There is somewhat of a transition plan on the way. And in Cuba, as you're probably aware, Raul has announced his successor.
Vice President.
Precisely. And after this term, the expectation is that he will not seek another term, and then it will be a quote-unquote new generation of Cubans, a younger generation.
And he's as much as said that. This is my last term.
Exactly. That will be coming in. But of course, the question is, exactly what kind of, administration will come next. A lot of people are saying it's not going to be much different from what we're seeing now.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN, an international edition, as we're going worldly with you. John Yearwood is the world editor for the Miami Herald. Tim Padgett is a correspondent for WLRN and for Time Magazine, writes about Latin America. Kelly Mitchell is with us from WLRN Miami Herald News, my colleague, and also has done some coverage of Latin America. When we come back, I want to get an update on Haiti, where we found out that the 2 out of 3, nearly 7 million people, they're still facing hunger in the more than 3.5 years after the earthquake in Haiti. We'll have an update on that and talk about drug policy and perhaps get into China's role in Latin America, and then we'll switch back to talking a little bit about the George Zimmerman trial. I'm Phil Latzman, Kelly Mitchell, John Yearwood, Tim Padgett. We're back with the Roundup in just a moment. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN, reintroducing our panel, Tim Padgett from our shop here at WLRN and Time Magazine, John Yearwood, world editor for the Miami Herald, Kelly Mitchell from WLRN Miami Herald News. I'm Phil Latzman. If you want to reach us on Twitter, that's a real good way. Journalists love Twitter. I'm at Phil Latzman, PhilLatzman. Tim, what's your Twitter handle?
Tim Padgett 2.
Tim Padgett 2. We're going to find
that
Tim
Padgett 1. And we're still hunting down Tim Padgett 1.
Tim Padgett 2. John, how about you?
Oh, that's easy. John underscore Yearwood.
John underscore Yearwood. And Kelly?
I'm at Kelly Mitchell, KellyMitchell. No last L, but if you get that far, you're going to get me.
Leave last L off for something.
Exactly.
So, all right. So, moving on to Haiti. And I mentioned this before the break. Haiti has always seems to get buried. I hate to use that analogy, but just does not seem to get the attention in times like this. All these international crises happening and things happening around the world, we tend to sort of forget that that country is still in trying to recover from that devastating earthquake 3.5 years ago, and of course a large Haitian American community here in South Florida. And John, it really did shock me to see this week that nearly 7 million people in Haiti are, that's two-thirds the population, are going hungry or are facing hunger issues. I mean, it's amazing.
Precisely, and that's for a number of different reasons. One of the things that we've been seeing in Haiti, that if there's any good news to come out of that, is that the government seems to get its act to have gotten its act together much more so than we've seen recently. But as you're quite right, the hunger continues. Also, a number of people are still, hundreds of thousands of people are still living in these tents after the earthquake. You know, one of the things I was reading a story recently about Haiti, and one of the things that I was reading it was that one of the problems with Haiti is that often there's this infighting, whether it's among politicians or other aspects of the society, and that's something that. That people were saying needs to be solved in order for Haiti to move ahead. And then I looked at who wrote the article, and it was written by Frederick Douglass in 1893 at the World's Fair. So it's something that's been going on for a very, very long time, and you hope that despite a lot of the infighting that we sometimes see, that Haiti would, there'll be far more of an effort made to focus on the issues that are really important to the people of Haiti, and one of those issues is the issue of hunger. But let me just say, though, that the Herald's Jacqueline Childs just recently wrote a story about the whole idea of what's happening with water, the gift of life in Haiti. And we're seeing that some people are saying, well, let's pay for the water. So people are starting to get a lot more responsible, and the international community we've seen, which is some good news, is starting to bring fresh water, clean water, piping that to various people's homes and building plants to make that possible. So there is some progress, but as is often the case in Haiti, the progress is so small and the problems are so huge that sometimes it takes a while to see it all.
Tim? Well, one of the big reasons we're seeing these shocking figures, 2 out of 3 in Haiti suffering hunger right now, is the tropical storms last year devastated so much of Haiti's agriculture, Sandy and Isaac. Mm. And one of the big questions right now is, at the same time, we're also seeing an increase in the number of detentions and interceptions by the Coast Guard in places like Puerto Rico, Dominican Republic. One of the big questions now is, could this food crisis spark another mass exodus of Haitians? And that's something we really have got to keep an eye on as well.
And certainly here in South Florida. Moving on to the Latin America, the drug policy, at least last week we talked on the show extensively about the bong bill, the anti-bong bill that was signed in Florida by Governor Scott, and sort of whether it's the right thing to do or whether it really matters. Anyway, you, Tim, wrote a very good post on our website, WLRN.org, about drug policies in the rest of our hemisphere and how they've advanced while the U.S. sort of has stayed behind.
Well, for decades, the rest of Latin America simply let Washington run the drug war. It wasn't something that they really were that engaged with until the bloodshed just started getting out of control in places like Mexico, Colombia, Venezuela, and especially Central America. And now that they're having to deal with all that violence, they're reassessing the drug war in Latin America, and they've pretty much come to the conclusion that it has failed. And they are pushing Washington to come up with alternative ways, getting Washington focused more on demand instead of just conventional interdiction. And the OAS, the Organization of American States, recently came out with a very surprising study that didn't outright call for the United States to legalize marijuana, but said, it would be a really good idea if you thought about it. And that's a very significant change.
John, the thoughts of legalizing drugs, not just marijuana, but around the hemisphere, they've changed in recent years.
Oh, absolutely. There's been a sea change in terms of the views of many in the region, particularly after a few states in the U.S. Passed the law, legalizing different aspects of marijuana. You saw a number of heads. I think they had a meeting in Mexico and saying that going forward we need to push the U.S. Much further into giving us far more leeway.
There are even some that are saying legalize everything. Just, I mean, especially with the Mexican drug wars, legalize it all, and 40,000 people a year don't die.
Well, everything is unrealistic. Yeah. I think that the debate is sort of the threshold of the debate is marijuana because it's not seen as really that more harmful than alcohol, and B, if you legalize marijuana, it could really put a dent in the billion-dollar revenues of these drug cartels.
And I wanted to touch on China. You did talk about this before. China's President Xi Jinping just left South America on his own little trip after President Obama and Vice President Joe Biden were there. It seems like China really is trying to gain influence in the U.S.'s own backyard, Kelly.
Well, one of the things I noticed when I worked for Latin American News and English for the RCN network out of Bogota was the fact that I started to see things that are not reported in the United States about how Iran, about how Turkey were coming into places like Ecuador, which had the largest supply of lithium, computer batteries, cell phone batteries, and they were going in to mine a lot of this. And the United States knew it, the government knew it, but they weren't considered a serious threat to usurping anything that the U.S. might do in the future. Once China came a knocking at the door, that seemed to change. Suddenly, the fervor was, we're going to lose the copper, the PVC industry, everything that's down there if the United States doesn't start to court Latin America, because they're the last real trade bastion that we have not embraced.
But an interesting quick point about that, and we've seen Xi Jinping apparently had a fairly successful trip to the hemisphere, and one of the first major trips he's made since becoming president. But one of the things that Oppenheimer reported for us last week, that his trip, particularly to Latin America, not as much to his meeting with Obama, but to Latin America, was in response to some angst on the part of some of his generals back in Beijing, because Obama recently visited Myanmar. And because of that, they're saying, you have Obama coming into our backyard and, in effect, trying to upset the apple cart back here. Why don't we do the same thing in his region, which, as you would see, a lot of the places that that she visited are places that are real strong U.S. backers: Costa Rica, Port of Spain, Trinidad, and Mexico.
I wanted to touch on this, and just Brazil has become such a force in our economy here in South Florida.
Definitely.
With the amount of people coming from Brazil, buying condos, spending money here. But they're going through a little bit of a sluggish economy, and that could have an impact on the entire state of Florida, which, if the people don't know, I mean, this is the number one trading partner for Florida is the country of Brazil.
Definitely, and it's looking more and more like the boom may be over in Brazil. The forecasters are saying that, we could see probably less than 3% growth, which is not bad. But when you compare it to the other so-called BRIC countries, China and India, it's a pretty lame performance. Dilma Rousseff, the darling president of Brazil, is suddenly seeing her first ever drop in approval rating. So yeah, there is a lot of concern.
Go ahead, John.
And the U.S. is working mightily to help support her. As you probably know, she'll be coming here this fall.
Right.
The only state visit of the Obama administration this year will be to Brazil and Rousseff when she comes in the fall. So the U.S. government is trying to do everything it can. And as you know, one of the places that the vice president stopped and spent most of his time in the hemisphere was in Brazil.
A quick question from Twitter. Jay Pellis asks, why, and this is on Haiti, why doesn't big business manufacture in Haiti? How come there hasn't been more of a push to John for big companies to come in there and start doing stuff?
That's a really good question. There was a push at the beginning with Bill Clinton, who has been very involved in trying to help. But in the last, the last couple of years, the government down there, is having a lot of problems really getting itself together. That's one thing, and there might be some changes to come there. But one of the things that that because of the sort of misdirection from the government, we've seen much less of an involvement by Bill Clinton. I remember like 3-4 years ago, he left. He came to visit us at the Americas Conference and said he was going to Haiti with over 100 business people. And by the time he got to Port-au-Prince, the number had really swollen. to far more than the hotel could pretty much accommodate. But we haven't seen very much of that lately. And part of the reason that we haven't seen that is because the government is still trying to get its act together on exactly what to do about businesses.
What about Martelli, though? I'm just curious, quickly.
Well, quickly on that, because I wanted to make a quick right turn to the Zimmerman trial for
you
a moment.
You can tell
here,
me afterward.
Go ahead. Yeah. quickly on
Some people may say Martelli spends more time in Miami than he does in Port-au-Prince. For the soccer match, and he also stopped by the Heat game, as we understand. But the good thing is that Haiti has a president. The bad thing is that a lot of people are saying the president isn't doing as much as he should.
We have to make mention of the fact, at least domestically, of the quick diversion of the Central Florida trial that's garnering international attention. Potential jurors in the George Zimmerman second-degree murder trial learned this week that if selected, they'd be sequestered for the duration of the trial. They, of course, fatally shot Miami Gardens teen Trayvon Martin last year, but says he acted in self-defense. Today's day five of jury selection in the case, as potential jurors face questions about how much they know about the case. And, of course, everybody knows something about the case, unless you've been under a rock. Under questioning from defense attorney Don West, one potential juror seemed to sum up the difficulty of the task.
Unless you've been living under a rock for the last year, it's going to be pretty hard for people not to have gotten some or a lot of information. But that's a tough job that you have, I'm sure, trying to find the people who can at least open their minds enough to hear what you have to say.
So having covered these types of sensational trials in the past, I mean, at this day and age in 2013, you might as well just throw that out, because how are you going to find any jurors that don't know anything about this case? It's just not it's not going to happen.
Well, what they're trying to do, rather than just ask that basic question, is assume that they do, but find out how much it colors their ability to make a decision. So they are working with that. One of the questions I thought was rather interesting, and it was asked of a black woman, was how much has Fox News influenced your way of thinking? And that, to me, would not have been a question you would have heard maybe even 4 years ago in a courtroom as part of a jury selection. So they're trying to figure out, all right, we will stipulate that you know about this, but in the meantime, can you put that aside?
Trayvon Martin's father, and we'll skip that cut, but says he's pleased. Tracy Martin says pleased with the process so far, urgent calm. But John, how is this being viewed around the world? Is there a lot of attention on the George Zimmerman trial internationally?
Well, there was a tremendous amount shortly after it happened. I remember talking to the governor about this at the time, saying that one of the big concerns that I was hearing from people around the world is that, look, you want us to come to Florida. You're trying to get businesses here, or whether you're trying to get tourists to come to the state. But there was a lot of concern that about stand your ground and what message you're sending to the rest of the world. I think some of that has subsided because, in fact, as you probably know, there were protests around the world shortly after this happened and mm-hmm. trying to get a day in court for Trayvon Martin. I think some of that has subsided, but I think the world is also paying close attention. And depending on the outcome of this trial, we'll probably see some more reaction around not only our hemisphere, but around the world.
All right. We wanted to just throw this in to sort of end the show. We're talking about sports, the Heat, and obviously the NBA Finals. But on Saturday, the Haiti and Spanish national teams, we alluded to this a little bit earlier, played at Sun Life Stadium. And as expected, Spain won the game. But about 70 minutes into the match, a Haitian player did actually manage to break free with the ball. Here's what it sounded like. That was from our Kenny Malone, who covered it. It was the only goal that Haiti scored. They end up losing 2-1, but it's sort of a feel good thing that they scored a goal on Spain.
Hey, look, I was in the audience. I was probably one of those people screaming. But at the end of the day, it really didn't matter who won because I guess the outcome was pretty much foretold. But the fact that Haiti, as you quite rightly said, Haiti was able to score a goal, and the stadium just completely erupted. It was an amazing, magical moment at Sun Life.
And of course, there's that other big sporting event, the NBA Finals, now tied at 2, Spurs and Heat. Heat even the series last night. The Big 3 is back. That means there'll be a Game 6 in Miami on Tuesday. But I think we're all thinking about what happened at Shuckers, at North Bay Village, where our hearts go out to those hurt in the dock collapse. Many people were watching the game there, and you've probably seen or heard the coverage here on this station or on TV. And certainly we're thinking about that. And we'll have an update, I think, throughout the day on this station. And we'll continue to follow that and look at dock safety and all that stuff, I'm sure, is the second day stories. And by the way, listen for my piece on Chris Birdman Anderson if you missed it on WLRN. It'll be on Only a Game tomorrow. And to listen for the next edition at 7 a.m. And if it's Saturday, it's coming up next. And you can listen for the next edition of our Sunshine Economy series with Tom Hudson Monday morning at 9 a.m. as he discusses the business of hurricanes and property insurance. And I'll be tuned in for that as well. Well, thanks to our panel, Kelly Mitchell from WLR Miami Herald News, John Yearwood, world editor with the Herald.
Thank you.
Tim Padgett from Time Magazine and from WLRN, our special correspondent. Thank you, guys. Awesome.
Love
awesome.
Thinking out loud.
Great show. That does it for the Florida Roundup this Friday, June 14th, 2013, Flag Day, fittingly. If you missed any of the show, we have it on our airwaves Saturday mornings at 6 a.m. We also post it on our website, WLRN.org. We're produced by Elaine Chen and Alicia Zuckerman, Public Insight Network analyst Steph Farrow. Our social media editor, Danny Rivero. Executive producers, Peter J. Meritz and Dan Gretsch. Our technical supervisor, Paul Leary. Until next week, I'm Phil Latzman. Thanks for listening and stay informed, South Florida.